Hello, I'm Penina from Circle Care Services, and welcome to My BCBA Life. Circle Care Services is an ABA therapy agency, and we're all about giving BCBAs the support and community you're looking for. With this podcast, you're not on your own anymore. You're part of a BCBA community committed to making this world a better place to BCBA. Once this episode is complete, you'll be able to obtain a free CEU certificate for the clinical topic discussed. You'll need to confirm your attendance by taking note of the three surprise words I will drop throughout this episode. There is a link in the show notes below of a form that will ask you for your information and the surprise words that we need to generate your CEU certificate. Thank you, and let's get started.
Welcome, Ariana, to My BCBA Life. It's good to see you again, and I'm excited for everyone to hear your expertise. So, if you could just start by sharing about yourself, how did you become a BCBA, and all those fun stuff, that would be nice.
Sure. Yeah, happy to. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here, excited to talk about a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. So going way back, I've been in the field about 20 years, and I started off doing, you know, typical route into behavior analysis. I feel like for a lot of people, I was studying psychology at the University of Minnesota, and I had to take a biopsych class as part of my psychology major, and I didn't really want to take biopsych. And so my advisor had recommended take this introduction to learning class. And I took it. I absolutely loved it. It just clicked. It made sense. So I went on to start doing in-home ABA therapy. There weren't RBTs back then, but I was an ABA therapist doing in-home, really EIBI treatment in Minnesota and the Twin Cities area. And I did that for about 3 years. And then I knew that I wanted to stay in the field, but take, you know, more of an oversight role, do more program development. So I went to graduate school at the University of Kansas and was fortunate enough to study under Drs. James Sherman and Jan Sheldon, which was an amazing, amazing experience. And really, while I was at KU, I really developed a lot of interest in just furthering, improving just EIBI treatment and care with young children with autism. And so when I finished my master's and my PhD there, I went into private practice. So I worked for a autism organization in the Chicagoland area and really focused on early intervention as well as birth through young adulthood care, but really found myself loving early intervention and treating young children with autism. So I came to Atlanta here. It'll be about 2 years, and I am currently the chief clinical officer at Atlanta Autism Center and really been able to purely focus on six and under, really comprehensive early intervention care. And that's what really led me to our topic today.
That's amazing. I'm just curious, you keep saying how you love dealing with early intervention more. I'm curious why.
You know, I feel like it's just amazing to see these little babies coming in and the progress and the impact that you're able to make. And after I just anecdotally started observing that, I started digging in more into the literature just after I was really finding that, you know, more of that traditional ABA approach that I was trained in, just a more of like the tabletop, more instructor-led, just wasn't very effective or efficient with these young learners. I just was really able to dig into just that brain plasticity and how impactful early intervention and being able to treat kids when they're, you know, right around two or just under two, that the brain is just in a place where you can make significant change and you can really catch kids up with their typically developing fears if you're able to provide comprehensive intervention at that age. So I think we see that as clinicians, but actually been able to see that that's supported by data is just really amazing and really rewarding.
It really is. It's like something you can never get bored of because every child is so different and just like, it's like magical in a way. just to give them that extra skill, which give them so much confidence. And their moms are like, what? I never thought my child would be able to do that. And then there's even on the lesser scale, but every like skill a child learns, besides for the skill, I feel like it really builds their confidence. And when a child has confidence, you know, the world's a limit. So you're doing amazing work. That's exciting.
Thanks.
I want to jump into the topic that, like you said, is near and dear to your heart, which is ASCENT within the clinical practice, working with these young kids. And there's so much to it, so much details that, you know, just that you are a pro at. And I would love for you to just take zoom out and just give a general introduction to, when you say ASCENT, what does it mean? What are you referring to? Just to make sure everyone's on the same page here. My first surprise word is record.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like ASCENT is still a relatively new topic to the field of ABA, but has really started to gain a lot more attention and traction over the last 3 to 5 years. I think with a lot of publications by, you know, people like Cody Morris and Hanley with his Today's ABA, and even just more recently, a great ASCENT article I would definitely recommend people dig into is the Brio and Smith 2023 article. And I think they do a really nice job of just defining ASCENT, defining ASCENT-based intervention. But drilling it down, ASCENT really refers to just the affirmative voluntary agreement to participate in treatment or in an activity. And it's specifically for individuals that aren't able to provide legal consent, right? So, which is our population, children or others with developmental disabilities. And the core tenets of ASCENT is it has to be free of coercion and it can be withdrawn at any time. And it also requires, as clinicians, an understanding of each individual's communication methods, whether that be vocal communication or with some of our non-vocal verbal clients, it's gestural or behavioral cues that indicate ASCENT or ASCENT withdrawal. So taking an ASCENT-based intervention approach, it's really just a model that emphasizes informed, ongoing ASCENT as integral to treatment. And it means honoring both ASCENT and ASCENT withdrawal during interventions, which is a lot different than more traditional ABA, right? Where it's like, nope, like you're here to get treatment. The instructor is going to direct it and we're going to do more follow through, more extinction based procedures. This kind of flips that on its head and really allows the learner to be an active part of their treatment and allows the learner to say when they want to participate and when they really don't want to participate. And that can be hard for a lot of people.
I have a question because there's so many times where kiddos could just be not in the mood or just, you know, in a bad, maybe they just had a bad day. How much control do the children have? But then I just also want to bring in the picture of the parents who they signed their kids up for this treatment. They want their kid. And at the end of the day, the kids they don't understand, right? When you tell a child they have to brush their teeth and they don't want to, but you know that if they didn't, then they're going to get a root canal, all those kind of things, right? How much could you push and where do you draw the line of like recognizing a child just not in the mood, but let's just push them a little bit to they're really withdrawing ASCENT that it could hurt?
Yeah, it's tough. It's really a tough call. And that's something that we are very upfront about with our families is that this is our philosophy to clinical treatment. And here's why. But within medical procedures, that's a little bit different. And I feel like most people understand that when it is something that's a risk to the health and safety of that client, that the learner doesn't always get to withdraw ASCENT. And even within our model, as far as like daily clinical practices, running programs, teaching trials, we do allow the learners to withdraw ASCENT. But if we do have certain hard no's too that BCBAs have to specify in each, we have a universal ASCENT protocol and BCBAs have to specify in that protocol what are the hard no's. And oftentimes those go back to health and safety concerns, right? So even things like, hey, you have to wash your hands after you use the restroom, right? So that's something we know is not only sanitary, but can help prevent the spread of disease and sicknesses and things like that. So that is a hard no. So if a client does withdraw assent for something like that, we are implementing more of, we follow Courtney Tarbox's work on kind extinction, where we're still holding that boundary and we're going to say, I know, we're going to empathize, we're going to validate their feelings. I know this is tough. I know you don't want to wash your hands, offering choices where we can, like, do you want to use the sink to wash your hands or hand sanitizer? But unfortunately, we have to do this before, you know, we go on to our next activity. So we do have hard no's. But if it's something, you know, just within normal teaching and programming, like let's say we're teaching a sorting task, like sorting blocks by colors, right? Working on one of those VB map skills. And a learner starts maybe to sort the blocks, then starts to withdraw assent, starts throwing the blocks, saying no. We may drop the demand in the moment, kind of recalibrate, because it's really on us as clinicians to figure out, okay, where's the breakdown happening, right? Like, how can I reanalyze this teaching situation to make it more motivating for the child versus getting into this, keep doing it, keep going, right? It's going to be this push and pull, this battle to get the task done. And then what is the learner really learning, right? We would rather teach them that we are trusted adults, that we hear you, we understand your feelings, and we're able to kind of modify the treatment environment to whether that's modify the task or just take a break and then come back at a later time.
I would think that a BCBA, like, you know, there's different kids who captivate to different BCBAs, right? I'm saying that's where the parent comes in, and it most people do work hard to say, like, oh, this kind of kid needs this kind of therapist, this kid needs that kind of therapist. You know, personality, there can be a personality clash. Did you ever have, like, where a child was constantly withdrawing, and that's just a sign, like, maybe this isn't a good fit? Like, how much of it is, like, the way that the task is being asked, or like you said, maybe it's not motivating enough? And I would say most of the motivation when it comes from a BCBA or their therapist, whoever it is, the hope is that the actual therapist makes it more as motivating as possible without outside reinforcers, right? Like, let's do this versus we're going to do tasks. You know, it could be more motivating, right, if you make it sound fun. So is there, like, right, a kind of a protocol of, you would say, for a BCBA to look inside and say, okay, how is this being offered to the kid? Is there a way to make it more enticing, etc.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you bring up a really great point as far as, you know, sometimes, you know, we get the feedback, these people just don't click, or like they're just not a good fit together. And sometimes that's the case. But what we've found is, even before we get to any of the teaching within our assent-based model, is we start with that relationship building, right? So, you know, formerly called pairing, now called more like rapport building, relationship building. We're starting there first, because that's really the basis upon which we can then teach, right? Because we really want to make sure that we build relationships with the clients, and the RBTs do and the BCBAs do, so that they seek out teaching and learning opportunities from them. So you're right, that's really the first step. And what we found is sometimes, even if they feel like they already did that step and then they get more into teaching, that they are having a lot of assent withdrawals happening during their session, is they need to go back a couple of steps, right? And start back with that relationship building and pairing process, just to make sure that, you know, whatever happened throughout the course of their treatment, that they need to get back to that place of trust and having that strong, solid foundation before they kind of move into more harder or more lesser preferred teaching opportunities, still within that naturalistic play-based model. So yeah, that's a great point.
Right. You know, it's also interesting as you're like talking and I'm like thinking how it looks in an ABA session in general, teaching a child who's not interested, like, what's the goal of teaching a child? So that they could learn. Now, if you're going to push to teach a child, and assent sounds like very like, I want to, I don't want to, but if a child doesn't want to and isn't in the moment able to, it's not a teachable moment, then what is then what are we doing anyway, right? Because the idea is to teach them, and if they are withdrawing, then just trying to get it out is kind of, I don't want to say it, but it's kind of selfish. Like, I have a program I need to do, let me just get this done. And then it just goes in one ear, out the other ear. The child could stare at you all she wants, but listening isn't, hearing isn't the same thing as listening. And if the child is not giving her assent and isn't active with you, then you could teach all you want, but you're going to have to do it all over again anyway.
Exactly. And it turns into a power struggle, right? And I think we've all, especially those of us that were more trained in that model, we've all felt that. And it never felt good, right? Like even when we followed through or we would extinguish something or they would finally match the card to whatever, it didn't feel good to be like, I won. You know, like it just, it never felt right. And I know the feedback from our team is implementing more of this model. Is that it just feels better. Like, yes, even though when Johnny came in, he threw a tantrum because he didn't want to hang his backpack up on the hook, I was able to, you know, get down with him, help him regulate, de-escalate. I let him know I heard him, you know, like, I'm here for you. We're going to get through this together. And then we'll go hang your coat up later on or your backpack up later on. It just felt better. It feels like, you know, it's more of a supportive and therapeutically appropriate relationship versus me coming in with these demands and following through on every single thing, even if you're clearly in distress for whatever reason, right? Whatever, maybe every other day he was fine going and hanging it up, but for whatever reason, he came in that day and wasn't and couldn't express why, but that we took the time to help him calm down, show him that we've heard him and that we would get back to that later is going to be more important and more meaningful in the long run, not only for him, but for him wanting to learn from us too.
Right. Exactly. It for sure is. I had two thoughts in this, but my first question, because it kind of leads to my thought, is why would you say, what are like the common causes of you're engaging with the child? Let's say you started to engage and then they withdraw. Why would a child withdraw their assent to participate?
I mean, I feel like the biggest one, it sounds super obvious, but that they're just bored. And they would rather be doing something else other than the task that you're presenting. And kids are usually pretty good about telling you that. But part of what we have our BCBAs do is they have to define what assent and assent withdrawal looks like for all of their clients. So in their, you know, electronic data collection system, we have documents and they're in there where they define that. And so oftentimes, you know, if RBTs get going, you know, wanting to run all the programs, maybe they're not going that extra mile to really make sure the client is excited and engaged, making eye contact, indicating, you know, their assent, right? And those indices of happiness. And the client's like, nope, sorry, I'd rather just go back to the gym. I don't really want to do this. And so it's immediate feedback for the RVT to be like, whoa, okay, maybe I need to think about how to present this sorting task or whatever the lesser preferred task is in a more motivating way.
My second surprise word is press. Is there any other, like, I'm curious, bored? Yes, I hear that one. Makes sense, a lot of sense. Yeah. No one wants to do something that's boring, especially a kid who's naturally more playful and doesn't realize the effect. Yeah. You know, it's not like, I need to do this because it's important for me to learn this. They don't think, why else would a child withdraw?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it's, you know, it would fall under just that general escape maintain behavior category. And I think just with even some of the more recent literature, you know, it could be escape, but it's also probably escape to something else. You know, a lot of what Hanley talks about, it's escape to tangible or a more preferred activity. It's or it's escape to a different, you know, more preferred form of attention. So I think it's just wanting to do something other than that in the moment.
It's like pretty simple. You know, like we're always looking for like complicated scenarios, but like just it is what it is. The child doesn't want to. He's withdrawing his assent. So figure something else out.
Correct.
Yeah. What I was thinking.
To your earlier point, sometimes it is just that relationship too, right? If for whatever reason they don't feel safe or comfortable or excited to be with whatever therapist that they're with, that could lead to it as well.
I had two thoughts because I was a teacher once and like in a classroom setting. And I had this, like, whenever I was excited to teach something or it was my favorite subject, whatever it was, the kids in turn would be like very taking to it. Just naturally is probably the, like, just from the vibe, you know, it wasn't like more preparation went into it than the other subjects. But as soon as I drifted off to something I wasn't so excited about, and I would never say that out loud, like, I don't want to teach this. It's not my fate. I'm not super interested in this. I just got to teach this. I never ever said that, but I saw their faces, like, just mellow. Without me mellowing, I try not to. I must have done it naturally, but I would also like dare to say that if it is coming to like a certain task that a child is constantly withdrawing from, I don't like to point fingers because sometimes the child is bored and you could put in a lap. But I think it is important to look inside and be like, how am I giving this? Or am I feeling excited about it? Maybe I need to up my excitement. I make this motivating for myself to teach, like, you know, make it exciting for me to. How can I give it over in a way that's exciting for me? Where I feel like usually when it's exciting for the teacher, then it's exciting for the child naturally. I'm just curious if you ever like saw that with your kiddos.
Completely. Yes. 100%. And, you know, I find even before the teaching part, even during that rapport building part, I've coached BCBAs that, you know, RBTs are struggling to really build that rapport, build that relationship. And the BCBAs will say, I'm showing them everything that I do with Johnny, right? I love to draw. So I'm showing them how he loves to draw pictures and things like that. But if I'm the RBT, I'm horrible at drawing. Like, I'm like the worst artist in the world, right? Like, I, you know, I'm just naturally better. I'm more active. Like, I like to do more physical things. And so it's also, I think, starting with empowering the RBT to form their own relationship with the client based on mutually preferred activities, I think, is like a lot of the basis of it too, right? To your point, because not only being excited about the subject matter, like, I love teaching tax or whatever it is, right? But also the context in which you're teaching, right? Because we're teaching all within play, within naturally occurring routines. So I might not, you know, try to do a lot of teaching during our art rotation, right? Like, that's not my, I'll do my best, but like really when we're in the gym and we're doing more of the physical stuff, that's when you can really get creative and maybe pull in some of those lesser preferred targets or programs where it's within the context that you really enjoy and have a lot of really cool ideas that the kid also might enjoy as well. So yeah, absolutely.
That's a really good point. Like when coaching to not just address the child's interest, but also the RBT's interest, because like a parent, it takes two, right? So you want both of them to be thoroughly engaged, because that's for sure where you see the most success, when both think to each other in a very positive way. Which I had this other question for you in terms of ASCENDS. When a child is withdrawing their ASCENDS, does it have to mean like, take a break, let's stop learning, let's just play? Or can we make when a child withdraws their ASCENDS a teachable moment for them?
Yeah, so we talk a couple of things when a child, and it really depends on if they're withdrawing ASCENDS with kind of more minor, you know, maybe precursor behaviors versus like high magnitude problem behaviors, right? Because naturally how we address those is going to be different. And also depending on whether they're withdrawing ASCENDS when we're holding a boundary, right? Versus when we're not holding a boundary. So we may, if it's, you know, a lesser, we're just doing a task, maybe a non-preferred task, and they're withdrawing ASCENDS, we can, you know, oftentimes pause, reevaluate the environment, represent something differently, give them a choice, right? Do we want to do one more sorting, sort one more block, or try a different activity and then come back? Or teach them or prompt functional communication response, right? Say, hey, can we take a break? So we do one of those three things, I would say, for the most part. So even if we are taking a slight break, it is important to at least have that pause so that we are acknowledging and reinforcing that ASCENDS withdrawal, right? Because we want them to feel comfortable to know that your words or your actions or your gestures matter and they are heard, similar to when we're teaching mans, right? That we run reinforce all mans in the beginning. But that we are also coming back to what we're doing, especially if it's, you know, not high magnitude problem behavior where we might need to consult with the BCBA redefine what that task is, or maybe we need to unpack it a little bit more or shape it up before we go into, you need to start 20 blocks. Maybe we start with 2 and then 4 and then do more of a changing criterion design. But we want to make sure that we are reinforcing that ascent withdrawal, but also making sure that we're able to get back to that teaching, just maybe in a more thoughtful way.
Got it. Yes. All those things are so important, like for the kids to walk out feeling like this person got me. I wonder, like, it's a big piece of it is really respecting the kids and honoring what they choose. Do you feel that kid ever take advantage of it, or they just appreciate it and they and not to?
I think just naturally, are they taking advantage? I mean, technically, yes, but we're showing them that that's okay because we're meeting them where they're at. We're still able to get just as much teaching done, if not more. Some studies have shown it's even more than doing that, you know, DTT, very strict table approach, because the trials that you are getting, you're going to have better attending, you're going to have higher motivation. And it's just, it's going to, those skills are going to maintain more than the ones that you just drill maybe when that child isn't fully available for learning. So I feel like just everybody feels better at the end of that. And the child is just going to learn so many more skills and in a more meaningful way.
My third surprise word is zipper. Yes, the meaningful way. I love that you added that because it's so true. Because when a child is engaged and they're learning it, in the child-led learning situation where it's play-based, then DTT is at a table. How often is a kid at a table? Not so often.
Right. Especially when you're 2 years old.
Yeah, no, a two-year-old does not belong at the table. They don't. I'm saying fast for when they're eating. No. They don't really belong at the table.
Correct.
You know? So
correct.
Teaching it where they're at, like physically at. Yes. The kids on the floor, they should be on the floor. The kids, you know, on a small, cute chair and rolling Play-Doh, whatever it is, that's really where they're physically at. You know, you don't want to teach them in a place that's very nice for the table. They go home and they're, what did you teach my kid? Because when I see him playing, he's playing the same way he played 6 months ago, which
exactly
kind of bring me to my next thing. Because there are some parents, I feel like now ABA has become more play-based across the board. So parents who go into it are expecting that. But have you ever had a parent who is more old school, more rigid in their approach to learning, and then they bring their child and they see what's happening and they're like, well, what are you doing? And how do you respond to them in that sense?
Yeah, definitely. I would say in my current role, the majority of our clients are brand new to ABA, so parents have been very open to the approach, especially when we explain it up front. Where we have gotten some resistance is from families that do come from maybe more traditional approaches to ABA, and really how we try to have those conversations is just, you know, starting with everybody's goals. So asking the parents what their goals are for their child, explaining, you know, what our goals are, which are oftentimes very similar, and explaining even if they think the way to those goals is maybe more of a traditional approach, explaining how we're confident that our way, we're going to meet at the same place, we're going to be able to achieve the same goals, but with less coercion, with more empowerment, with respecting their autonomy, and their dignity and their rights, and also how that aligns with our ethical code that, you know, asks us as BCBAs to obtain not only, you know, informed consent from families, but also assent as much as possible from our clients. So we try to approach it that way of like, hey, we have the same goals, but we believe our approach is going to get to that same place, but in a more ethical and therapeutically positive way.
And I love how you go, like, you know, you're in this together, you want to get to the same place. It's just a different way than you would imagine. Have you ever had pushback, or have most parents been like, wow, I like this, or teach me more? I'm curious what your parents' responses have.
Yeah. Fortunately, nobody has really just dug their feet in the sand and been like, no, I really want you to do this. But I would imagine if we did, that we would just say, listen, I understand that is your belief and that's your philosophy. This is ours. And so therefore, we might not be the best clinical provider for you, you know, given that we would make a referral at that point because that, you know, they may have a different opinion and that's fine, but this is our opinion and this is why we believe this. And this is who we are. And this is the type of care that we committed to give to all of our clients.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think parents would run away from it. You know, from the rigid end, they hear what people would run away. But it, when it makes so much sense and they hear it from, like, you know, the goals will happen in a more meaningful way, a more child-led way. And I can't imagine being there to push back. I was just curious if you ever experienced it.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think it's helpful, too, because we involve parents quite a bit in therapy. So they're really able to see what therapy looks like within that ascent-based, play-based model. They're able to see what that looks like with the RBTs, with the hopes that they're able to do those things eventually at home as well. And I think that could be another strategy that clinicians might be able to use is, hey, well, just let me show you what this looks like. Of course, if we get informed consent to do that, but also with their child and being able to see what that looks like and the progress that the child's also able to make.
And I think I really want BCBAs to walk away from this realizing when you pay attention to the child's withdrawal sin, I don't want anyone to ever think like, oh, so then the teaching is going to be less or our programs are going to run slower. I want you to, like, really reinforce, like, kind of what you keep saying, but just to, like, put it in its own right. How important with paying attention to the child's interest in engaging and when they withdraw and how that can positively impact the learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's really where, too, I think this model, we are all center-based. So we're all on site. All the BCBAs are on site because it's never, and we tell our RBT this, it's never just on you to be making all these decisions. We give you different strategies to use. Your BCBA will train you what to do when your client withdraws assent. But all of that is under the close supervision of the BCBA, and the RBTs are communicating with the BCBAs. Hey, you know, Bobby withdrew assent almost 8 times today when I was trying to run these targets. Can we strategize or brainstorm a different approach? So it's really a team effort as well to not only maintain really ongoing communication, but also that the BCBA can help support and really think creatively of maybe how we need to modify different activities or tasks to work on programs that might not be as preferred with learners, maybe across the board doing all the relationship building and all those things. It's the BCBA that can kind of help guide how we can make that more successful during that child's therapy sessions.
Amazing. And you gave so much information and we gave it over so positively. Is there anything else you want the listeners to walk away hearing from you?
Yeah, I just think if you're not familiar with ascent, look into it because I really think that's the direction that the field is moving, which is really exciting. And it just aligns very closely with, like, some of the authors that I mentioned. Look into Hanley's Today's ABA and skill-based treatment is very much aligned with ascent and how we respond to challenging behaviors within that model. Bridget Taylor's work on compassionate care. Brio and Smith article I mentioned is a really great place to start to just learn more about it and just know that it's important. And I think that you're going to feel better about your programming and your approach if you do it within more of that ascent-based treatment model.
Thank you, Ariana. Not only were you so knowledgeable, it's clear the experience that you actually practically engage your clientele with. And thank you for the amazing work you're doing for the population that needs it so badly. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, too.